Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. It's such a delight to see a room full of people out to hear about a book. My name is Cheryl Strayed. I wrote Wild over these last couple of years, and it's the story about my hike on the Pacific Crest Trail the summer of 1995 when I was 26. This hike, how many of you in the room know what the Pacific Crest Trail is? This is so interesting. Like, at different places I go, at first I was assuming everyone knew what it was, and then I would be in some audiences where only like a few people would have heard of it. Hi. And I had never heard of it in December of 1994 when I was standing in line at an REI just outside of Minneapolis. I was a waitress and I was trying to be a writer. And I was at what I really think of as the sort of bottom moment of my life. My mother had died very suddenly 3.5 years before at the age of 45. She died 7 weeks after she found out she had cancer when we were both seniors in college. And that moment, when that happened, I knew that life as I knew it was over. But I didn't know how profoundly over it was. And what happened in the 3 or so years after my mother's death is really everything in my life that had been sort of the stabilizing force. My family, I had gotten married really young, my marriage, and even myself. Like, I couldn't figure out how I was going to live in the world that didn't contain my mother. And this was all, of course, happening at the same time when I was really also just a young woman trying to figure out how I was going to grow up and be in the world the sort of way we all do. And so a whole bunch of stuff collided to really bring me into this bottom moment. I really could not sustain my marriage. I did all kinds of bad things that you're not supposed to do when you're married to someone, which sounds funny now. It's not. and I got myself tangled up with, a lot of self-destructive things, sex and drugs. And I was at this place when I saw this guidebook that said the Pacific Crest Trail, Volume 1, California. I was waiting to buy a shovel, which only the other day I realized that's a metaphor, you know, like that I needed to dig myself out. And I should have used it in the book if I could just have one more draft. But so I was waiting to buy the shovel and I saw this book and I picked it up and I read the back and I was really just killing time. And it told the story of this trail I'd never heard of. It goes from Mexico to Canada, along the crest of the Sierra Nevada and the Cascade Range through California, Oregon, and Washington. And it sounded amazing. And it sounded like something really big and incredible and something that I needed to attach myself to. I had grown up in the wilderness of northern Minnesota. That home was lost to me, the 40 acres of land that my family had basically homesteaded. And I think in some ways, retrospectively now, I realize that my decision, you know, that reading that book and having that kind of blooming feeling in my gut that said, even though you've never gone backpacking before, you have to do this trip. I think it really does go back to that thing that was the wilderness was home. And I had to go to the foreign wilderness to really find it. So I bought that guidebook, not that day that I first picked it up, but a couple days later. And I set about going to hike this trail. And a few months later, I did. I had never gone backpacking before I set foot on the trail. My first night of backpacking was my first night on the Pacific Crest Trail in the Mojave Desert, which is, it turns out, not such a great idea. I had never packed my pack before the morning of the hike, which is also not a good idea. I had shot heroin 2 days before beginning the hike. Another really bad idea. And But these things were all lessons. The morning of the hike, when I packed my pack, I had, you know, purchased all this great gear at REI, because all those lovely people at REI say, well, you need this and you need that. And they would describe everything I needed. And I just bought all this stuff. And it sort of seemed like I was a backpacking expert by the time I purchased all that stuff, because I'm such an American. It's like, if you've got the stuff, you're set. And So I put all this stuff in my pack, and then I couldn't lift my pack, not even like a hair. And so there's a scene in this book that describes what happened, like how I managed to get that pack, you know, on my body and walk away. And that was a metaphor I used in the book. That wasn't lost on me, because I really went out there feeling like in my life I had this weight that I couldn't bear, that the grief and all the messed up things I'd done, it was an unbearable life, and I had to make my life better, and I didn't know how to do it. And so what happened when I went backpacking is I had to grapple with that stuff in a really literal way, in a really physical way. And any of you who have had to labor hard for things, I know you know what I'm talking about, how that can be such such a powerful lesson. And you don't know, like I went out there thinking I was going to go on some spiritual quest, and I would be, you know, weeping upon the beautiful sunsets and feeling all these things. And actually what happened is I went out there and I was just, you know, in agony and thinking about how I was going to get water and how I was going to get, you know, hike faster and carry this stuff. And so it really shifted my perspective, and it shifted so much. There were a lot of surprises. I went out there and in addition to not being able to lift my pack, I didn't see, the first 8 days of my hike, I didn't see another human being. So I knew I was going to be alone. I didn't know how alone I was going to be. I thought I was, I'd done a lot of hiking at that point, but I thought I was always going to be, you know, encountering other hikers the way you do on day hikes often. And so the solitude was really profound. And these first 8 days were sort of like this baptism. I realized that I had brought the wrong kind of gas. So I couldn't cook any of the food that I'd brought with me. That was a bad thing. You know, other things happened that I'm going to just let you read about. But the passage I'm going to read to you tonight, so about a month into the hike, or I should say about 10 days into the hike, I met this other hiker, and he was the first person I met who was on the trail backpacking. And that was the first time that I realized that my pack was really big. Like I thought that like it was just normal that you couldn't lift your pack, because like I'd never gone backpacking. So I was like, well, this is how it is to be a backpacker. And he was like, oh my God, what do you have there? And I was like, well, I have a foldable saw, for example. I don't know what I was bringing it out there for, but in case I wanted to cut some things. But I'd never used a saw before, you know, but somehow I needed a saw out there. But so I started to meet other people. And that was one of the things that was the most beautiful things of that summer, is meeting people and learning from them and having really myself reflected back to me through what they would tell me about myself. And so I'm going to read to you about an experience along those lines. I should say, too, when I first met that first guy, he said, well, we're going to have trouble north of here, because the Sierra Nevada is completely socked in. 1995 was a record year for snow. But I hadn't thought to research that, because I hadn't thought about snow, because I thought it was summertime, the snow would be gone. But I didn't realize that there was still all this big time snow up on the mountains. So what ended up happening is all of the hikers that summer had to bypass big sections of the trail. And there were a couple people who went all the way through. They're called the Three Young Bucks. I write about them in the book. But so in the scene that I'm going to read to you, that's what I'm doing, is I have to get off the trail. I have to hitchhike a ride on these highways that make this big loop so that I can miss the high section of a trail. And I'm about a month into the hike. And here is what happens. This just takes about 13 minutes to read or so, and then I'll answer your questions if you have any. I was standing by the side of the... I should also say my backpack's nickname was Monster, and it deserved that name. And also, everyone who wasn't hiking, every time I would meet people, like regular civilian people, they would say, well, you have a gun, don't you? And of course, the answer was no. But I did have this whistle that was very powerful, because the packaging said world's loudest whistle. So I was standing by the side of the highway just outside the town of Chester, California, trying to hitch a ride when a man driving a silver Chrysler LeBaron pulled over and got out. I felt a sick flutter in my gut as I attempted to discern in the flash of a second what his intentions were as he made his way toward me on the gravel shoulder of the road. He looked like a nice enough guy, a few years older than me. He was a nice guy, I decided when I glanced at the bumper of his car. On it, there was a green sticker that said, "Imagine World Peas." Has there ever been a serial killer who imagined world peas? "Hey there," I called amiably. I was holding the world's loudest whistle, my hand having traveled to it unconsciously over the top of Monster and around to the nylon cord that dangled from my backpack's frame. I hadn't used the whistle since I'd seen that first bear on the trail, but ever since then I had a constant and visceral awareness of where it was in relation to me, as if it weren't only attached to my backpack by a cord, but another invisible cord attached it to me. "Good morning," the man said, and held his hand out to shake mine, his brown hair flopping over his eyes. He told me his name was Jimmy Carter, no relation, and he couldn't give me a ride because there was no room in his car. I looked and saw it was true. Every inch except the driver's seat was crammed with newspapers, books, clothes, soda cans, and a jumble of other things that came up all the way to the windows. He wondered instead if he could talk to me. He said he was a reporter for a publication called the Hobo Times. He drove around the country interviewing folks who lived the hobo life. "I'm not a hobo," I said. "I'm a long-distance hiker." I let go of the whistle and extended my arm toward the road, jabbing my upright thumb at a passing van. "I'm hiking the Pacific Crest Trail," I explained, glancing at him, wishing he'd get in his car and drive away. I needed to catch two rides on two different highways to get to Old Station, and he wasn't helping the cause. I was filthy and my clothes were even filthier, but I was still a woman alone. Jimmy Carter's presence complicated things, altered the picture from the vantage point of the drivers passing by. I remembered how long I'd had to stand by the side of the road when I'd been trying to get to Sierra City with Greg. With Jimmy Carter beside me, no one was going to stop. "So how long have you been out on the road?" he asked, pulling out a pen and a long, narrow reporter's notebook from the back pocket of his thin corduroy pants. His hair was shaggy and unwashed, his bangs concealed, then revealed his dark eyes, depending on how the wind blew. He struck me as someone who had a PhD in something airy and indescribable, the history of consciousness, perhaps, or comparative studies and discourse in society. "I told you I'm not on the road," I said, and laughed. Eager as I was to get a ride, I couldn't help but feel a little delighted by Jimmy Carter's company. "I'm hiking the Pacific Crest Trail," I repeated, gesturing by way of elaboration to the woods that edged up near the road, though in fact the PCT was about 9 miles west of where we stood. He stared at me blankly, uncomprehending. It was mid-morning and hot already, the kind of day that would be scorching by noon. I wondered if he could smell me. I was past the point where I could smell myself. I took a step back and dropped my hitchhiking arm in surrender. When it came to getting a ride, until he left, I was screwed. "It's a national scenic trail," I offered, but he only continued looking at me with a patient expression on his face, his unmarked notebook in his hand. As I explained to him what the PCT was and what I was doing on it, I saw that Jimmy Carter wasn't bad looking. I wondered if he had any food in his car. "So if you're hiking a wilderness trail, what are you doing here?" he asked. I told him about bypassing the deep snow in Lassen Volcanic National Park. "How long have you been on the road?" "I've been on the trail a month," I said, and watched as he wrote this down. It occurred to me that maybe I was perhaps a tiny bit of a hobo, given all the time I'd spent hitchhiking and bypassing, but I didn't think it wise to mention that. "How many nights have you slept with a roof over your head in that month?" he asked. 3 times, I answered, after thinking about it. "Is this all you have?" he asked, nodding to my backpack and ski pole. "Yeah, I mean, I have some things in storage, too, but for now, this is it." I put my hand on Monster. It felt like a friend always, but even more so in the company of Jimmy Carter. "Well, I'd say you're a hobo," he said, and asked me to spell my first and last names. I did, and then wished I hadn't. "No fucking way," he exclaimed when he had it all down on the page. "Is that really your name?" "Yeah," I said, and turned away, as if searching for a car so he wouldn't read the hesitation on my face. It was eerily silent until a logging truck came around the bend and roared by, oblivious to my imploring thumb. "So," Jimmy Carter said, after the truck passed, "we could say you're an actual stray." "I wouldn't say that," I said. "Being a hobo and being a hiker are two entirely different things." I looped my wrist into the pink strap of my ski pole and scraped the dirt with the tip, making a line that went nowhere. "I'm not a hiker in the way you might think of a hiker," I explained. "I'm like an expert hiker." It's true, I was by then. "I hike 20 miles a day, day after day, up and down mountains, far away from roads or people or anything, often going days without seeing another person. Maybe you should do a story about that instead." He glanced up at me from his notebook, his hair blowing extravagantly across his pale face. He seemed like so many people I knew. I wondered if I seemed that way to him. "I hardly ever meet any hobo women," he half whispered, as if confiding a secret. "So this is fucking cool." "I am not a hobo," I said more vehemently this time. "Hobo women are hard to find," he persisted. I told him that this was because women were too oppressed to be hobos, that most likely all the women who wanted to be hobos were holed up in some house with a gaggle of children to raise, children who'd been fathered by hobo men who'd hit the road. "I see," he said. "You're a feminist then." "Yes," I said. It felt good to agree on something. "My favorite," he said, and wrote in his notebook without saying his favorite what. "But none of this matters," I exclaimed, "because I myself am not a hobo. This is totally legit, you know, what I'm doing. I'm not the only one hiking the PCT. People do this. Have you ever heard of the Appalachian Trail? It's like that, only out west." I stood watching him write what seemed like more words than I'd spoken. "I'd like to get a picture of you," said Jimmy Carter. He reached into his car and pulled out a camera. "That's a cool shirt, by the way. I love Bob Marley, and I like your bracelet, too. I should say I wore a MIA POW bracelet. A lot of hobos are non-vets, you know." I looked down at William J. Crockett's name on my wrist. "Smile," he said, and snapped a shot. He told me to look for his piece in the fall issue of the Hobo Times, as if I were a regular reader. "Articles have been excerpted in Harper's," he added. "Harper's?" I asked, dumbfounded. "Yeah, it's this magazine that..." "I know what Harper's is. And I don't want to be in Harper's. Or rather, I really want to be in Harper's. But not because I'm a hobo." "I thought you weren't a hobo," he said, and turned to open the trunk of his car. "Well, I'm not. So it would be a really bad idea to be in Harper's, which means you probably shouldn't even write the article. Because standard issue hobo care package," he said, turning to give me a can of cold Budweiser beer and a plastic grocery bag weighed down with a handful of items at its bottom. "But I'm not a hobo," I echoed for the last time with less fervor, afraid he'd finally believe me and take the standard issue care package away. "Thanks for the interview," he said, and shut the trunk. "Stay safe out here." "Yeah, you too," I said. "You have a gun, I assume. At least I hope you do." I shrugged, unwilling to commit either way. "Because I know you've been south of here, but now you're going north, which means you're soon entering Bigfoot country." "Bigfoot?" "Yeah, you know, Sasquatch, no lie. From here all the way up to the border into Oregon, you're in the territory where most of the Bigfoot sightings in the world are reported." He turned to the trees as if one might come barreling out at us. "A lot of folks believe in them, a lot of hobo folks, folks who are out here, folks who know. I hear Bigfoot stories all the time." "Well, I think I'm okay, at least so far," I said and laughed, though my stomach did a little somersault. In the weeks preceding my hike on the PCT, when I decided not to be afraid of anything, I'd been thinking about bears and snakes and mountain lions and strange people I met along the way. I hadn't pondered hairy humanoid bipedal beasts. "But you're probably fine. I wouldn't worry. Chances are they'll leave you alone, especially if you have a gun." "Right," I nodded. "Good luck on your hike," he said, and got into his car. "Good luck finding hobos," I said, and waved as he drove away. I stood there for a while, letting cars pass without even trying to get them to give me a ride. I felt more alone than anyone in the whole wide world. The sun beat down on me hot, even through my hat. I jabbed my thumb at a car and realized only after it passed that it didn't look so good that I was holding a can of beer. I pressed its cool aluminum against my hot forehead and suddenly had the urge to drink it. Why shouldn't I? It would only get warm in my pack. I hoisted Monster onto my back. and ambled through the weeds, down into the ditch, and then up again into the woods, which somehow felt like home to me, like the world that was mine in a way, that the world of roads and towns and cars was no longer. I walked until I found a good spot in the shade. Then I sat down in the dirt and cracked the beer open. I didn't like beer. In fact, that Budweiser was the first whole beer I'd ever drunk in my life. But it tasted good to me, like beer tastes, I imagine, to those who love it, cold and sharp and crisp and right. While I drank it, I explored the contents of the plastic grocery bag. I took everything out and laid each item before me on the ground, a pack of peppermint gum, 3 individually wrapped wet wipes, a paper packet containing 2 aspirin, 6 butterscotch candies in translucent gold wrappers, a book of matches that said, "Thank you, Steinbeck Drug," a Slim Jim sausage sealed in its plastic vacuum world, a single cigarette in a cylindrical faux glass case, a disposable razor, and a short, fat can of baked beans. I ate the Slim Jim first, washing it down with the last of my Budweiser, and then the butterscotch candies, all 6 of them, one after the other, and then, still hungry, always hungry, turned my attention to the can of baked beans. I pried it open in tiny increments with the impossible can-opening device on my Swiss Army knife, and then, too lazy to rummage through my pack for my spoon, I scooped them out with the knife itself and ate them hobo style from the blade. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So I'd love to open it up for questions. And I know people, I was just going to say you're going to be shy, but I don't get to tell my don't be shy story.
Oh yeah, go ahead.
It's a good one. So in Boston, people like, see, now I'm a little afraid of what you're going to ask, because the last time this happened in Boston, this man, this elderly gentleman in the front row shot up immediately and said, did you ever have sex with anyone in exchange for food? And I was like, so taken aback. I said, no, but would you like to have dinner? It's a good thing he had already eaten, but, I was just aghast, but I did not have sex with anyone in exchange for anything. Except pleasure, I should add. But anyway, yes, you.
First of all, I absolutely love your book. It's totally fabulous.
Thank you.
And it would make me want to hike the Pacific Crest Trail, except I already did.
Yay!
This guy
here,
my husband, and we were 57 and 53, respectively.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, wow.
Good job.
Anyway, one of the things that I really am also a writer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so just in case everyone couldn't hear this, she said she and her partner hiked the... What year did you guys hike the PCT?
2004.
So 9 years after I did. And and then the question was, she said that I wove the sort of story of the hike with the backstory of my childhood and my earlier 20s, like what brought me out onto the hike. And so when I asked, she said, what do you say when people ask what your book is about? I say it's about my 1,100 mile solo hike on the Pacific Crest Trail and everything that brought me out there. And I think that if I'm going to get it like a second sentence, I say, you know, the wild in the title, and you know, you've read the book, so you know that really that wild, it really references so many things, so many, kinds of things, everything from the wilderness and the wild and that experience to wild love and wild grief and wild sorrow and wild acceptance and, going wild and being wild and learning how to, you know, all of those things. I really worked the hell out of that word, metaphorically in the book, I think. And that's what the book is really about. You know, it's that internal and external. And it's about a bunch of stuff too. I mean, in some ways it's about a rite of passage. You know, I think, you know, I think we have rites of passage at different times of our lives, but certainly all of us, who, you know, in your 20s, you have to have one. Like we grow up and then we have to grow up again for real. And people do that different ways. And sometimes people don't do that. And they have to have some big, terrible thing go on in their 30s and 40s because they never did that work in their 20s. And so I think in a lot of ways that too, it's like, it's really a universal story about like how I grew up. Yeah. So other questions? Yes.
I felt so sorry for your poor feet.
You know, it's funny that my feet have totally recovered, but it did take a while. My toenails. I lost six toenails over the course of my hike. I'm giving away some of the book. I hate to say it, but you know, I did slowly but surely. I mean, my feet were such a problem the whole time, and they did recover. It took a few years for those toenails to really grow back. But you know, it's amazing what the body can recover from. I mean, I have two kids. My first child was 11 pounds, who I gave birth to him, not in a hospital, naturally. And I remember thinking, I will never be the same again. But I, you know, it's like, it's then you spring back and there you are. And we're almost good enough. And, you know, and it's like the body is a beautiful thing that regenerates and repairs itself. Right? Yes. So did I know I was going to write this book? And because I was trying to become a writer, did I take notes for that purpose? You know, I was a writer. You know, I mean, I was a writer since I was a little kid. And so I always kept, you know, really detailed journals. And so it wasn't like I just kept a journal on this trip. But I will say I journaled a lot more on this trip because I was so often alone. And so, you know, sometimes I would journal like 2 and 3 times a day. Like I would stop for my lunch and I would write a page, or that at the end of the day, I'd write, you know, a lot, because I had no one to talk to a lot of the times. And so I wasn't conceiving it, like, I wasn't thinking, well, this will be great for the book someday, you know, but it was great for the book. Like that, that hobo standard issue hobo care package, that's in my, like, that paragraph of that book is like almost exactly the same in my journal. I mean, like, you know, I even just the way I wrote it, like the order in which I listed the things, I just, it's right straight from my journal. And I would have remembered most of that stuff, I think, but probably fuzzed some of the, like, you know, thank you Steinbeck drug, you know, like I wouldn't have remembered that it said that, or, you know, exactly how many six butterscotch candies. And so I did use it in that way. And, you know, I was so set on writing the book that did become my first book, which is this novel Torch, that, you know, in Wild, for those of you who've read Wild, like I talk about sometimes writing my novel in my head, you know, that was the novel I was writing in my head. And it took me several years after that to actually write that novel. And, but I did. And so it was like, I think that everything that happens to me, I feel like maybe I'll someday write about it. But so it wasn't like I thought I'll never write about this, but I certainly wasn't out there thinking this is going to be a book someday, you know? So, yeah. And then, you know, for the longest time, my husband was always saying, you should write about your hike on the PCT. And I always said, well, you know, I don't really have anything to say about it. And I didn't, strangely, and until I did. And then I did. What else? Yes. Right. So the question's about details and memory and how I conjured these things. And it's a couple of different things. I had a detailed journal. I have a really good memory. Also writers, you know, I'm somebody I write a lot about my life. And so, the thing that I can compare it to, you know, when you like meet up with an old high school friend and you get to talking and you start remembering things together. And then because you're having that conversation, you remember more and more and more, you remember things you thought you forgot. And writing about your life, that same thing happens. You know, things that you are just sort of blurry unfold before you, and you go down one avenue and suddenly you see all these other little alleyways that you had forgotten were there. And so it is like a muscle you work. And so that's true. And then also just the art of memoir is, I mean, and that's in some ways, you know, pretty much the line to me that differentiates it from journalism. And that is, you know, that scene I just read to you, like, do I know that the guy, you know, his hair blew in that way exactly in that moment? I don't know, but that's how I remember it in my mind. And so, you know, when you're writing a novel, what you have to do is, the writer John Gardner said, and I might be just paraphrasing him a bit here, but you have to create a continuous and vivid dream for your readers. So you're just dreaming up these people in this situation, but you have to create it on the page as if those people feel real to you, you know, and that's, we all know that those great novels that we just feel like these are real people. And so you have to do the same thing with memoir. And yes, it is nonfiction, but I'm also having to like really make that world vivid. You know, there are moments on every page that you would say, well, that's probably not like, I mean, where if I look at a flower in some particular moment, you know, again, it's not like, you know, I wrote, you know, at 2:32 on the afternoon of Wetabara, I saw, you know, a Indian paintbrush, but you know, I remember it in a kind of bigger way. And so then I brought it to you in the book. And, you know, it also memoir too. It's, you know, it's subjective truth. Like I wrote, it's interesting. A couple of people I wrote about in the book. My brother is a big character in the book in some of the hardest scenes. My ex-husband is a character in the book. And, it's interesting. Like the both of them have read the book and loved the book and said, thank you. You know, and they also say, you know, oh, it's like so interesting to hear this story from your perspective, you know? And it's like, it's not that it's not true. It's just from my perspective, you know? And, my husband, if he, or my ex-husband, thank God he's not a memoir writer. But if he were, he would remember slightly different, you know, it wouldn't be that he would just remember, he would characterize our divorce a slightly different way, than I did. And, you know, all of those things. So that's, it's the beauty and the pain of memoir. Yes. Thank you.
How is it to put that out into the world?
Yeah.
To me, I feel like it'd be like, oh my God.
Yeah. So the question's about honesty and being and telling all the terrible things about yourself. You know, I know you didn't say that, but I you know, I think people ask that. I have answered that question like every day for a month, you know, and, it's so interesting to me because really the best answer I have is like, I cannot imagine writing any other way. I cannot imagine writing in a way that I wasn't, that I was trying to kind of protect myself or shield myself. Like, I think that the interesting thing to me about writing, about literature, is that we reveal like all the different layers of truth about the human condition. And when you're writing about your life, you have to do that about yourself. You know, and I think you have to be very honest. And I think the thing that everyone fears pretty universally is that you'll be judged and disliked and condemned. And I will tell you that I've been doing this now, not just in this book, but in other things I've written. And like, I have just received thousands of emails from people saying, you know, thank you for being honest about your life. I recognize myself in you. I relate to you, they see themselves in that. And maybe like 6 emails in like 10 years where somebody's like, you're a stupid slut, you know? But it's like, that's what's amazing, you know? So like, I go, okay, you know, 6 people think I'm a stupid slut. And then like, you know, all these other people say, thank you. And so what I mean to say is you're mistaken. Like, you're mistaken about the fact that people won't like you if you, tell them who you are. And we all think that that's what's going to be the outcome, but it's not the outcome. We love people who tell us who they are in life and in writing. So be brave. Yes.
I came to you through The Sun with Dear Sugar.
Uh-huh.
Everybody wants to know this is with Dear Sugar. And thank God you came out so that I could read your other writing, all your writing that I will read.
Thank you.
And I read your book in a day.
Thank you. Yeah. So the question's about my Dear Sugar column. I write an advice column called Dear Sugar it's on the rumpus.net. So how many of you know about Dear Sugar in here? Okay, that's always interesting too. Okay, so about half of you. So yeah, a couple of years ago, about 2 years ago, I was asked to write this advice column that like basically nobody was reading on this website that had just started called The Rumpus, and the pay was nothing, and I had no qualifications to be an advice giver. So I was like, sure. Yet another example of something that I just sort of stumble into blindly, and it ends up being like one of the best things that I've ever done. what happened is I just decided that I would do the, and also that I would also get no credit for writing this column because it was like anonymous under the name of Sugar. People wrote to me anonymously. I would write the letter. Nobody who I was knew who I was. So I started I decided that I would just give advice, like not like the typical like Dear Abby like advice. I would actually like really give advice, and I would just take everything apart and tell all these stories from my life, and you know, do things that people thought were like, well, what the hell is she doing? And but then it would end up being okay. You know, it's like and so I did this, and people started reading it, and it became this exciting, fun thing for like, it created this whole community. People read it. People loved it. People wrote to me, and I started to get really invested in it too. As a writer, I learned so much, and it was also this incredible outlet for me. I've always wanted to actually help people. And, it was this way that I could write and also really actually help people. For example, during this book tour, several people have come up to me at the signing and said like, oh my God, you know, one of your columns like changed my life. And I'm always like, well, what did you do? Like which column and what did you do? And they're like, I left my wife. And I'm like, oh, great. So I'm like a home wrecker, but, that's one of the things. And I'm like, is that good? No, but, I do know that sometimes that's good. But, I really start love doing it. And one of the challenges of it is that I'm not paid. So that is a challenge. I'm trying to also do things that paid the mortgage. And also the way I write the column, I feel like I answer so universally. There's a point that I'm going to reach where I've really spoken my piece, you know, that I don't really have anything more to say, because you can like refer to that other column or this column. And so I don't know how long I'll keep being Sugar. I'm on hiatus right now. And in July, on July 10th, a collection of my Dear Sugar columns is coming out as a book called Tiny Beautiful Things. Going to be coming out as a paperback original published by Vintage, which will be really exciting. I'm going to keep writing it for the next several months, and then I'm just going to see what happens. I don't want to, like, I've always wanted to write out of a place of, like, really wanting to write. And I don't want it to become something that I'm doing because I have to do it, you know? And so when it reaches that point where I'm not really learning or feeling like it's expanding what I'm doing as a writer, I'll stop. Or maybe I'll like stop and like do one every once in a while, you know? Yes, I'll tell you. We'll have a whole like crying session and yes. Thank you. And I wondered if you kind of worked through your relationship with your mother and your dad in the writing of the book, or had that actually already really happened to you? Maybe the books, the process of writing the book? Right. So the question is about my mother is such a big character in this book. She's dead in this book, but I mean, so it's the portrait of her, and my memory of her. And did I process that relationship well as I wrote the book or before I wrote the book? And the answer is really, you know, it's sort of this never ending experience, I think. And so, you know, I certainly had, you know, grieved in that big way, you know, and then moved to different levels of grief and resolved a lot of stuff and come to terms with stuff and accepted stuff. But then of course, when I'm writing the book, it's absolutely like, you know, when you're writing with that kind of honesty and you are digging into all the layers, you find more layers, you know? And so there's one chapter in the book, again, sorry to those of you who haven't read it yet, but, there's one chapter where I make a list of all the things my mother did wrong. And as a mother, and this was so hard because, as you know, when you read really the opening of the book, my mother was an amazing person. She was my hero. I love her absolutely, and I do not have any idea how she managed to be such a good mother to me and my brother and sister. I especially know that now that I'm a mother, because she had, you know, very few resources, and the fact that she loved us so well is just like blows me away. But it's also true that my mom is a human being and she had flaws, and I was her daughter, and daughters expect their mothers to do everything exactly as they want them to do it, right? And so, especially young women, you know, she died when I was in college, and this was during this time where I was really supposed to be detaching myself from my mother and you know, bitching about her to all my friends, and then like figuring out that, oh, I really do love her, and going back. You know, I didn't get to do that process because she died. And so then she had to be like the angel, you know, mom. And so there's this moment on the hike where I just suddenly, it was my mother's 50th birthday. And I realized my mother was not ever going to get to be 50. And I was just enraged. And so I listed all the things that she had done wrong, all the mistakes she'd made, all the things that pissed me off. And when I wrote that chapter, I thought, okay, I cannot have that in the book because it's too mean. It's like mean. How can I say mean things about my mom? And I think that then coming out the other side of that and understanding that actually makes her, I think, a more sympathetic character because you see her more complexly, that she's a human being. And, but there it was like, that was a surprise for me that I had to like, I had to kind of heal like more in that way about that relationship. And it happened through the writing. Like I didn't plan, I was just suddenly writing it, you know, because I remembered that's what I was doing that day. And I thought, okay, I'm going to have to put that in the book if I'm going to tell the truth. So, man, we're getting deep in here. One, so we should probably just do one more question. Yes.
Mine's not that deep. Do you hike now, and have you tried to instill that into your children?
The hiking, yeah. Do I hike now, and do I instill that in my kids? Yes. You know, I do hike, and my kids. I really would like my kids to be backpackers. They're 6 and 7, so they're too young to, you know, like strap a pack on yet. But I would love to. My husband and I have this little plan that, like, right in that moment before they become surly teenagers, we're going to, like, you know, get them to go on, like, a 500-mile hike with us. The Washington section of the PCT is our plan. And but the thing about kids, they can do it, but they, you know, anyone on the trail, you have to want to be there. You have to be invested. You cannot force someone else to carry a pack and walk through the wilderness every day, day after day. So we're trying to come up with ways that they'll get excited about doing it on their own. So, but yeah, we do hike, and, the kids are very, last summer or a couple summers ago, we went on this 5-mile loop, and they're like, you know, five, you know, at that point, like 5 and 6, and they did this rugged 5-mile loop through the wilderness. And we get to the very, like, we're almost back. And, we come to this incredibly treacherous river, over which there's supposed to be a bridge, but there's not. And instead there's like this big, terrible looking log. And if we slip off the log, we're definitely going to die because it's like way above this river. But we couldn't go back the other way because it was going to be dark, and then we would die then too. But so anyway, so my husband and I have this whole like, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And he's just like, you know, we just each grabbed a kid and went across. And it's to this day, it's like this, like the most terrifying thing I've ever done. And it's the worst decision I've ever made as a mother, because we could have died, but we didn't. But so to this day, whenever we go hiking, my kids go, "Mommy, not the loop, not the loop." So we've started off sort of bad. Like, I do not traumatize the children would probably be the first. Again, started off with bad. But so I'm trying to kind of, you know, purge that memory from their minds. So thank you so much. I will be more than thrilled to sign books and talk to you all.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.